What happens when two Bass Road Warriors spend quality time talking music and life with one of their peers? Find out every Monday at 8 on Notes from an Artist. Bassist, educator, author David C. Gross, and bassist and head honcho of KnowYourBassPlayer.com, Tom Semioli, trade eights with the legends of rock, jazz, funk, blues, folk, country, and more. Notes from an Artist. Revealing conversations with the legends who've created the soundtrack of our lives. Every Monday at 8 on CygnusRadio.com. And check out previous episodes on our podcast. Notes from an Artist.Buzzsprout.com.
Hi, this is David Gross, and along with co-host Tom Semioli, I want to welcome you to another edition of Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com. We hope you've enjoyed last week's show featuring composer, trumpeter, producer, and educator Ben Neal. Tonight, we have part two of this fascinating interview. And tell me, where do you get to hear Brian Eno, Lamont Young, Edgar Varèse, John Cage, Anton Webern, Steve Reich, Philip Glass, all on one show? Well, enough from me. Let's get started.
You mentioned the societal, like, instant gratification, like the drama of a suite listening to prog rock, for example.
Yeah.
Intro, the solo, the verse, chorus, verse, bridge. It's almost like you're talking about people are more affected by sound than format.
Yes.
It's just like where we are in an instant gratification society. One of the things, to use an analogy, is the sport of baseball is decreasing. Why do fewer people watch baseball, or young people don't watch it at all? Because it's a contemplative sport. It's a sport where the action is up here. It's not necessarily on the field, like, let's say, ice hockey. Basketball, things like that. So you go to a baseball game now and they keep all these sound blasts and videos coming on because that's what it takes to keep people's attention. So, you know, by your observations, yes, it's the sound. You've got to hit them in 7 seconds.
And it's got to sound right. You know, I mean, it's got to, when I say right, it's got to fit into whatever the context is. And of course, this is what Spotify is trying to push the whole act of listening, to push the focus away from the artist and the album and into this idea of a mood playlist, which these things are created, I think, largely algorithmically, with, I'm sure, with some, you know, human intervention. But those are the kinds of things that algorithms are really good at, is looking across, you know, thousands of songs and analyzing their frequency content and, you know, how they're going to hit the listener. And I think that's something that we all, you know, have to, you know, really be aware of. It's almost like I'm thinking about Brian Eno, because I'm going to Greece on Monday. And one of the things I'm doing over there on Wednesday night is I'm seeing Brian and Roger Eno perform in the Acropolis. Now, it's like Eno's whole concept of ambient music. I think sometimes it's almost like all music is ambient music.
That was Marble by Roger Eno and his brother Brian Eno. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
I guess maybe when you're at a concert, then people give it their full attention, but then everybody's got their phone up and they're looking through the phone. So it's mediated, you know, it's this kind of, there's like the way that the technology has advanced both on the production creation side and on the consumption side, I think has had a drastic effect on music. I don't like to come down and say that it's better or worse.
But
I do think what you're talking about of like the attention span, the compression of everything in our lives as being just because there's so much information coming at us all the time, everything is much more compressed, and those kinds of shifts, you know, have happened before, you know,
and they reflect,
and they'll continue to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's reflected in music, because that's,
yeah.
I think one of the ironies of all of this is if we look at 4 minutes and 33 seconds, the entire piece by John Cage was what was going on within the audience.
That's right.
And that was a long time ago. And if you read Silence, you really begin to understand that concept.
I am sure some of you are wondering, what the heck was that? Well, that was a piece by John Cage, composer John Cage, called 4-3-3, or 4 minutes and 33 seconds. It was composed in 1952 for any instrument or combination of instruments, and the score instructs performers not to play their instruments during the entire piece, throughout all three movements. The piece consists of the sounds of the environment that the listeners hear while it is being performed. Wild, huh? Well, this is Notes for an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
Talking irony, Tom likes to talk about how Justin Timberlake, when he goes to make a new record, he doesn't sit down at a piano or a guitar. I'm going to make beats.
Yeah,
that's right.
And don't you find it ironic that the most primitive form of music, rhythm, is now the electronic milieu. There's something really completely wacky about the whole thing.
Yeah, I actually wrote an article about that for Leonardo Music Journal some years ago. And there's near the end of the 90s and one of the end of the century, the many end of the century articles that were coming out around that time. John Pareles, who I have always loved his writing.
Right.
He had an article in the Times called The Rhythm Century, and talking about how rhythm really dominated music throughout the 20th century. And he referred to, you know, ragtime, jazz, the Rite of Spring, and then, of course, all the different forms of dance music that evolved. And so, yeah, again, one of my kind of theories or ideas is that while, and maybe this is, as some kind of a consolation, so we don't all feel like we're just being manipulated or that we're tools of the technology, is that many times I think the artistic ideas, and of course, Cage being probably the greatest example of that, but the artistic ideas are introduced first. And then the technology has to kind of catch up with that. The technology comes into existence. Why did we get electronic music? It was because of Webern.
That first piece you heard was Anton Webern's Six Bagatelles for String Quartet. And just now we heard Ionization by Edgar Varèse. And believe it or not, that particular piece is what Frank Zappa said made him want to create and write music. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
And Cage, you know, prepared piano, in a sense.
Right,
that's like
right.
A proto-synthesizer, you know? And he wrote all that music for percussion, you know, like noise and everything. So I do think there were seeds of that all through the 20th century. And I think that has to do with the influx of non-Western music. I would shy away from that word primitive, but, you know, if
right.
you go back to Debussy, you know, he was very much influenced by gamelan music. That was more on the pitch side of things. But minimalism, you know, which is what I've been kind of associated with in terms of the music that really appealed to me and how it connects with pop music. And that's where I wanted to be, was somewhere where you could have intelligent music that was also something people wanted to listen to.
Sure.
Minimalism all kind of came out of non-Western musical sources, whether it was Steve Reich with the drumming, Philip Glass study with Ravi Shankar, and Lamont Young and Terry Riley with Pandit Pranaths. Yeah, I think music became much more global. You know, that was all happening. But the electronics, you know, well, it's the power of the DJ. I mean, if you're talking about pop music, I remember the composer Scott Johnson once said to me, in pop music, there's two kinds of music. There's song and there's dance. And more pop music is all dance music. I mean, I think those things are with you know, hip hop and you know, all the various forms of EDM that cross over into pop. So yeah, it's all heavily, you know, rhythm is like the primary ingredient. Rhythm and timbre. And that's
yeah.
What's different about that is that those two things were always there before. But if you go back 50 years, I think harmony and melody were the dominant.
Right,
you know? Right. But to clarify, when I meant primitive, I wasn't thinking of culture. I was thinking of long, long time ago when someone hit a stick.
Yeah.
And that was rhythm.
Yeah.
That's what I meant by that. Right. Also, you make a really great point in the Channels Diffusion article regarding how music has, or music technology has really increased more rapidly than let's say war toys. I really like that concept.
That's
and
a
the
good
reason
concept.
I bring that up now is because if we go back to Bell Laboratories, and Otto Luening and Uzichevsky and stuff, you're really treating sound. Do you remember the original Environments records?
Oh, absolutely. I had some of those on vinyl.
I studied with Irv Tibel for a while.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And one of the interesting parts about that was how he manipulated tape.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the most fascinating part. As a matter of fact, did you know that he was actually called to DC to debunk the fact that you cannot, Nixon was basically saying you cannot, or you can chop things up without knowing it.
Yeah.
You know, when you're editing, right?
Yeah.
Irv was sent down there to prove that that's not true. That you
interesting
find out. And my final exam, he gave me and the rest of the kids in the class the original Watergate speech and asked me to and everyone else to manipulate it, which was very cool. Because what I ended up doing in one part is I turned the vocal around.
Yeah.
You had it going forward and backwards, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
I am not a crook.
Yeah, of course. Now that you know, you've got these deep fakes. I get these. You know, I'm getting ads for apps now where you can do that with video. You know, you can basically make anybody say anything. You know, so
exactly.
But yeah, I mean, I think you know, Cage certainly it was somebody that had so much impact in the way that we moved from. Thinking about from music more towards sound, you know, you know, it's interesting. I teach one of the classes I teach is music online, and it's a class that's for anyone can take. It's not just for music majors. And I always introduce that as part of the sort of background of, you know, how music was becoming more interactive. And, you know, that piece, I think it was, what was it? I can't remember the exact date. It was in the 40s or maybe 50s, I guess. Yeah, it was in the 50s. But it still elicits very strong responses. Some people it really angers them, you know, like, I can't believe I have to, what is this shit or something, you know? And then other people have a kind of, you know, some sort of like transcendent experience when they really think about that concept of, you know, art just being all around us all the time. So, yeah, I mean, I think the ideas have a lot of these ideas and the things that I talk about in that article. One of the points that I was trying to make in the article is that while we tend to think that all of this stuff is just happening because of the technology, but I think there's a real strong case to be made that a lot of this stuff was already happening anyway. Mm-hmm. It's just that the technology sped it up and increased how widespread it was. And who could have thought that, you know, these ideas would actually 50 years later, after these Fluxus artists and people like that were thinking about this sort of democratization, that, you know, basically everybody in the world would be able to create and release music. And that's a mixed bag. I mean, I'm not going to deny it. I mean, you know, I think about, you know, I say to people all the time, you know, I you know, think about, you know, like making a record was a privilege.
Right,
it was something that you had to strive for. And even if you could afford to make your own record up until, you know, like, for the last 20 years, I mean, you couldn't do anything with it. You couldn't distribute it.
Right.
And I mean, my whole life revolved around records, you know, I mean, I did a record. Now I'm going to tour for a couple years. And then you start working on the next record while you're on the road. And now, you know, doing recordings it's just like posting photographs to Instagram or something like that. And that's a hard thing, I think, for anybody who had that kind of a relationship that, you know, obviously we all have had, to make that leap. And how do we preserve the actual value of the art itself, not its value in terms of getting somebody to look at something so their data can be mined, but the actual importance of the art itself. And that's something that I don't think is clear, you know?
Well, it's a breakdown between the audience and the artist. I mean, and you mentioned this is not something new. I mean, you talk about the Fluxus artists where they would have the audience participate. I remember in the 90s, David, Todd Rundgren did a record. I don't know how successful it was.
And you could meld parts, right?
Yeah. Right. You could pick out the parts and you could make your own Todd Rundgren record.
Yeah. Todd was always very advanced with all that stuff.
But it's kind of that's happening now. I think we mentioned the last time or maybe on another show. I have two friends of mine, married couple, Billy Leroy and Lorraine Leckie, who we're going to have on the show. Mm-hmm. And Billy does a TV program, Billy Buys Brooklyn. Maybe you've heard Billy Antiques, Baggage Battles a few years ago. And Lorraine is an accomplished singer-songwriter. And he makes videos on his iPhone 6, which is primitive tools nowadays, that 5 or 10 years ago, you would have needed a camera crew. You would have needed a professional editor to do. My friend over there in the left-hand corner, David Gross, I don't think he's ever taken a radio editing course in his life, but you know, he's got the tools in his hands and
don't be frightened, Ben.
Don't be frightened. You know,
I'm the same way with video editing. You know, I mean, I have video editing, Photoshop. I mean, all these different things. I mean, we all kind of, you know, have to learn to use them as we need them more and more, you know, just to be not even artists, just to be like effective citizens.
That's true.
My wife is a filmmaker.
Okay.
And whenever she's editing, she calls me down to do the edit because she thinks that musicians, obviously because of the rhythmic, are really well versed at being able to help things flow.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I guess is true. And once again, I have Photoshop all that stuff as well now. But I wanted to go back to something you were saying earlier about the arts. And you say something in this. It's a great article, by the way. Oh,
thank you for wading through it. I know it's rather dense.
Oh, my God. I got some questions I wanted to talk about with you. But there was a book that my literary agent back 35 years ago recommended to me. It was called The Banquet Years. Are you familiar with that book?
I'm not.
By Roger Chittock? Mm-mm. Well, where it actually comes into our conversation is there were four artists profiled. Mm-hmm. Rousseau, Eric Satie, Apollinaire, and Alfred Jarret.
Okay.
We're all hanging out together back then. Mm-hmm. Then you've got Cage, Cunningham. Now, with watching the Eternal Network 3 minutes and so, they were trying to do it again. And if you think about the Beatles, it was avant-garde French film. It was art, fashion, music.
Yeah.
It became almost contemporary in a popular way.
Yeah.
Then the loft scene.
Yeah.
I remember doing some gigs with Daniel Carter, the trumpet and sax player, mm-hmm. where a guy by the name of Music Witness would paint the live music. So it's always been going on. And then you make a quote that William Duckworth.
Yeah.
I will favor you with this ode, Tom. Virtual music is a decentralized universal art form. Anyone with a computer and internet access can be involved despite their location in physical space. Wow. That sums it up.
It's like the rock and roll ethos. You know, the great thing about rock and roll music and folk music was, hey, anybody could do it. Three
That's chords. Right.
But Tom, you know what's interesting about that quote?
Yeah.
It's 16 years ago.
Yeah. Wow. No, that's a really visionary book. I mean, and I, you know, unfortunately, Bill died at an untimely death of pancreatic cancer. But you know, he was a pioneer of, doing participatory kinds of pieces. And I actually use that book as one of the textbooks in this course that I was mentioning, Music Online. I think it's, you know, it's so true. And also you could add to that to a certain degree, like without a whole lot of musical ability, what we would have called musical ability talent. Right. And, you know, I mean, not only is it the location, but as things move more and more toward the whole artificial intelligence, algorithmic kind of composition, you know, based off of machine learning of, you know, and machine analyzation of massive quantities of music, then, you know, the whole question of authorship and you know, it all becomes questionable. I had one other thought, just to jump back a little bit, if I could, when you asked about this whole question of how rhythm became has become so significant. Rhythm being, as you say, the most what we think of as being, you know, it's just one of the most basic kind of elemental aspects of music. And I had a relationship with the late psychedelic philosopher Terence McKenna. He wrote a book that I really enjoy called The Archaic Revival. He, in addition to all of his writings about and his philosophies based off of his various psychedelic experiences down in the Amazon and everything, he was an art historian. And one of the things that he talked about, and it's sort of an outgrowth of McLuhan's idea of the global village, was that as this technology became more and more powerful to connect us all, that there would be this kind of resurgence of a kind of tribal mentality. And I think, you know, the rave scene, which I was involved with heavily in the 90s.
That was Bug Funk by our guest today, Ben Neal. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
Again, I come back to the DJ. I find the DJ to be such an influential figure and in many ways a kind of archetype, not only for the musician, but for the human being, you know, and that we're constantly having to, we have to make choices. We have to sort all this information and try to make sense of it. And, you know, that whole sensibility of the DJ and how the DJ was a performer, but not a performer in the sense of a person playing an instrument, that it was about providing this kind of a framework or an environment for social interaction, which is a more tribal, you know, primal kind of approach. And I think we, you know, despite our being connected with all these electronic tools, I think we also, and of course now we, you know, we're experiencing that even more with COVID, is that we still long for those kinds of communal experiences. Or I hope we do. I mean, I hope we don't get to the point to where we're just all in pods, you know?
Yeah. Well, performing wise, I think Tom and I talk with all our interviewees regarding streaming as the new way of performing. Yeah. And yet when it really comes down to it, you want to play in front of people.
But that's, you know, that's raised a lot of hackles. Now, we spoke to Ron Carter about that, of course. We all know Ron Carter. Ron's like, no, nothing replaces live music. And we agree with that. There's nothing like being there in person. We spoke to an indie rocker yesterday, Ed Rogers, and he had the same feeling. And the thing is, well, look, Ron's 84. Ed's in his 60s. We're in that age bracket. Yeah, to us, live music is the medium. But to someone who grew up, let's say, in a COVID world where we're going to constantly be sequestered and separated from each other, a streaming concert is no problem. It's like when back in the 90s, back in my music journalism days, I would review performances where there were no musicians on stage. Someone sang to a soundtrack. And in many cases, these rap artists just lip synced and the crowd enjoyed it. And they had a great time. To me, to the David and myself, and you who grew up in the jazz rock and roll era, that's sacrilege. Yeah. You don't do that. But
it's funny because when I came into the whole, when I started really getting involved in the whole world of DJs in the early 90s, I had been developing my Mutant Trumpet system in the context of the more experimental downtown New York music scene. Right. And in that scene, it would have been anathema to get up in front of an audience and play back a pre-recorded tape. I mean, the whole thing was about what you could do live with your electronics.
That was Chemistry of Seven, also by our artist, Ben Neal. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
When I got to the point to where I started, you know, I got really interested in, I found it was very exciting to to be part of this whole new scene of electronic music that was coming out of in the early 90s, and this whole new audience, a whole new kind of way for me of getting my music out there. It was hard for me to let go of that, you know, and I eventually did. I never wanted to call myself a DJ, really, but I remember DJ Soulslinger. He was, I don't know, kind of the king of the rave scene in New York. He had the store Liquid Sky downtown, which was kind of rave central, like for all the clothing and everything. And I remember he was in my studio. He was working on a remix for me. And I was kind of talking about this problem, like, well, you know, I do everything live. And he's like, what difference does it make? It's all you. It doesn't make any difference whether it's live or recorded. But to me, that was something that I had a real problem with, you know, it just never felt right to stand up and press play and call that a live performance, you know. And of course, a lot of times I was doing things where I was dealing with technologies that were very fragile and, you know, it was hard to get everything to work right. And it was a lot of stuff to lug around, but yeah, that's a kind of conflict that, you know, I bumped up against a number of times. And I frankly still, as popular as electronic music is, I was just speaking with David Behrman yesterday, who, you know, was a real pioneer of interactive computer music. I did two albums with him back in the late 80s.
That was David Behrman featuring our guest tonight, Ben Neal, on Mutant Trumpet. That was a tune called All Thumbs. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
I still don't feel like enough work has really been done in that field of really, of course, I'm interested in that because that's my artistic project, but is to create really meaningful connections between the more traditional modes of music making and performance and all this technology. I'm afraid there's an awfully lot of it where people do just press play, you know? Yeah, right. And there again, what happens to the art of performance if that just keeps on going that way? Do people still learn to play acoustic instruments 50 years from now? I'm not sure. Because I don't have to tell you how damn hard it is. It takes a lifetime to learn to play an instrument really well, you know? So I don't know. It's just there's so many questions, you know?
Yeah. Tom always talks about the fact that when people play bass now, they're really not official bass players.
It's one of five instruments they play, and this is a product of the Pro Tools era. Now, right, for example, right, in the days of analog tape, you had to hire David C. Gross at triple scale, probably, right, David?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
So he could nail that track in the first two takes because it was analog tape. You didn't want the tape to wear out, and you had to save the other tracks for the vocalists and the horns and et cetera, et cetera.
And also time was money.
Time was money, as fast as possible.
Yeah.
Right. You didn't have a recording studio on your living room couch.
Exactly.
Now with Pro Tools, and again, you know, the democratization of the arts, you know, you are everybody. You're the drummer, the singer, the keyboard player. And, you know, what we found with modern bass players is that it's one of five instruments they play. They haven't dedicated their whole life to it. But then again, it's fine, especially for, you know, let's say a lot of modern rock. I mean, I could give Ben Neal that Fender bass behind me and you could practice it for about 2 weeks. And, you know, once you get over the calluses, you know, you go on stage with the Foo Fighters in front of 50,000 fans at Madison Square Garden. It's three chords. It's basic rock. You don't really need to study at Berkeley to play that type of music. And it's the same thing. Our wives always question, how come you don't interview any young bass players, young, handsome bass players? And, you know, it's just that they're good play. They're proficient, but like I said, it's one of five instruments they play and they don't quite have the personality. We grew up in an era where if Jaco or Marcus Miller played on a record, you'd say, oh, that's Jaco. That's Marcus. That's Paul McCartney. That's John Entwistle, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, yes, as David mentions, a lot of the personality is gone because everybody's multitasking.
But again, I think that still comes out.
Yeah.
I think there's still that component, but it tends to come out more, in contemporary popular music, at least it tends to come out more through production, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's like through an overall approach to to getting a sound and a vibe. And, you know, like, so yeah, it's like you have to, I don't think, my feeling is that music, it's not that music is necessarily less creative. It seems that way,
yeah.
But music is still highly creative, but it's just that this, all the explosion of this technology of the last 30, 40 years has shifted it to the point to where it's almost unrecognizable in terms mm-hmm. of what was important in this more traditional pre-tech, you know, pre-computer, really, you know, world of making music. But I still, you know, there's still innovation. There are still things that prize and can stand out. I think it's harder. I don't think there's any question. That's just, again, a function of the numbers. And
yeah.
And I think also, you know, so much because, you know, so much of the way music is being promoted now and everything. And you know, I mean, who really reads music publications anymore?
I don't,
I mean, even like the blogs and everything, yeah. I don't really think they're as influential, you know, so it's sort of like everything becomes marketing, you know, everything yeah. is storytelling, like what, so the story of the artist in a way almost becomes more important than, you know, what the music is. And of course, you know, some of these artists that you're talking about, you know, Bowie, who is, you know, to me, like the Tower and Eno, I mean, all those guys, you know, they were doing glam rock. I mean, they had that going on too, but I think it was more about the music though. You know, I do think it was more about the music, and that's what concerns me. And that's where I feel, I guess, as an educator, that my role is to try and impart to my students the inherent essential value of the art form itself. And we can't stop all these changes from happening. There's no way we can put the all these different genies back in the bottles, but we can at least try to make a bridge. And I think that's really important in order for our art form to sustain, you know?
So. Sure. If you want to think of one of the positives, Sweetwater sold over $1 billion worth of musical instruments
yep.
during COVID.
The bass players, I think, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, and also there's a gold rush going on toward all these plug-in manufacturers and sample loop, you know, there's the merger of Isotope and Native Instruments, and
yes.
Splice, I believe, was purchased by one of the big investment firms. And of course, you also see all the explosion of the value of intellectual property, of classic songs and everything. Right. You know, I mean, so music still has value, but it's all in flux, you know, and that's the time we're living in. And you know, we have to try to make sense of it. And I've got to say, I really enjoy talking with you guys because I feel like a lot of the musicians of our era are not really looking for a way to make this kind of a connection, that there's just a lot of people that are just so turned off by the whole thing. They're just like, I don't even want to talk about that. You know, I'm just going to go bury my head in the sand. And I think, you know, we can't do that. You know, I at least I don't feel I can, you know.
And maybe for example, music won't have the same longevity, like you mentioned Bowie and yeah. you know, yeah, I can listen to Before and After Science, you know, almost 50 years after it came out, or Aladdin Sane.
Yeah.
But maybe that's not going to be the way anymore.
I think that might be the case.
And which is fine, I guess.
And again, as I say in my article, it might even get to the point to where, and this is what, you know, Jacques Attali bring myself. Oh, there
hey,
it
that was
it
cool.
dropped out for a second.
I love that.
I like that. David, put a bass line to that.
Well, there's a King Crimson. I repeat myself while I'm under stress. I repeat myself while I'm under stress.
Yeah.
I repeat myself while I'm under stress. I repeat myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. We have to sample that
then. Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, I do think, I sort of lost my train of thought there. Sorry about that.
It's okay. You know, yeah, I wanted to tell you, there's another irony.
Yeah.
That here we are talking about rhythm and you're going to see Roger and
Yeah.
You know.
I know. I know. I read a press release last night. It said they're going to have five people on stage. I was saying to my girlfriend, like, well, you know, it's probably not going to be that exciting. Like, you know, two guys up there plunking keys every 30 seconds or something, you know, like some generative thing playing back. Yeah. But I guess they're going to have a few different musicians. And, yes. You know, so I'm sure they'll have some you know, nice projections and stuff like
right,
that.
Yeah, some
I knowing, think not to knowing, get too petty.
Yeah.
I would recommend David Toop's book, Oceans of Sound.
Oh, I love that book.
It's a good primer for guys that actually want to start discovering this. And also, I think the Eno book on music for airports, it's a very interesting approach to the whole panoply of sound. You like that panoply?
You keep using those big words, David. David has a new thurosis that he
refers to. That's right. It's Roger's thurosis.
All right. So, well,
Can I give you a few questions I just want to ask? Maybe we'll do this as our tips from the top kind of segment.
Okay. Right?
So one of the things that I'm noticing is a lot more people nowadays are interested in the concept of just intonation.
Okay.
Obviously, as a bassist, on a fretless bass, we've been working with just intonation almost exclusively our entire lives. Now, besides, let's say, listening to Lamont Young and maybe even reading his book on, what was it, something about a straight line?
I mean, the best things to read of him are on his website. He has like the notes to the well-tuned piano and things like that. I mean, they're very technical, but yeah. But Kyle Gann's also written a lot about just
The arithmetic book.
Again, quite technical, but.
But I just get the feeling that in and amongst everything else, there are the scientists who are exploring as they can.
I think that's true. You know, Dave Soldier, he's a composer. He had the Soldier String Quartet. He's also a neuroscientist. He just came out with this book, which I'm actually going to be using for a new class I'm teaching called Music, Math, and the Mind. And he's talking a lot about that, about just intonation. And again, I don't know how much it will be actually get into the mainstream, because I'm not sure that it's something that is, you know, quite at that level of accessibility. But if you think about it, before the keyboard, all music was done in just intonation, because it was all, you know, it was all free, you know. But then the keyboard was where they had to nail it down so you could multiply in different, so that you could modulate to different keys. With brass, we are always working with the overtone series. And I've always been really interested in the overtone series as a kind of structural device, like not only the idea of pitch. I came up with this idea I called rhythmonics, which in terms of basically trying to do a sort of unified way of doing music, where you would use the same kinds of relationships for the pitch that you would for the rhythm and the large scale form. And I mean, Stockhausen worked with that. Henry Cowell had the Rhythmicon, you know, which did something like that. But again, I think a lot of the influence of non-Western music also might have something to do with that, that people's ears are getting much more open now to other culture, to the music of other cultures that isn't locked into our conventional 12-tone system. And also, so I think one of the things that I'm involved in with my Trove project, and it looks like I'm going to be doing a release with Six Degrees Records and their records and their records and their records and their, I don't know why it's dropping out sometimes.
Great. That's another song, David.
It looks like I'm going to be doing another release with Six Degrees Records in this style in early 22, but this kind of very meditative, ambient type of music, the music for sleep, like these are some of the most popular playlists on Spotify. Yeah. You know, again, because of the fact that the way people are using music now is almost like a drug, or, you know, like burning a stick of incense in the room or something, you know. And so I think there's a more of an awareness of the kinds of deep, profound experiences that just intonation can have. I mean, because it really can. I mean, it creates a whole world of auditory hallucinations, basically, that, you know, Lamont Young was really the pioneer of that. And other people obviously are working with it too. But I think it's very interesting. And it's something that I wouldn't say everything I do is in just intonation, but I do work as much as I can with natural harmonics on the trumpet. And I've done a number of pieces where I've used natural, like a multiple brass instruments, all playing just on natural harmonics, which is kind of another way of getting out that just intonation thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the reason I bring that up is because I think at a certain point, starting with the beats is all well and good, but there is something about melody that has to creep back in.
Yeah.
And I think, particularly in EDM and in raves, putting this kind of a sound on top could very well. And now you've got keyboards that you can just go, oh, 3-2.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
So the modular synthesis, you know, that is very popular now too. I mean, of course, you know, that you're not limited to any kind of tuning structure, you know, really. Right. I mean, so you can be, you know, much more open. And again, that's something that that most musicians would have never even been aware of, you know, a few decades ago. And now, it's, as you say, it's becoming much more available. Yeah.
I remember when I was back at Berkeley a million years ago and I picked up a copy of Lydian Chromatic Concept, because I was always perplexed that if you're going up, there's no F.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's an F sharp up there.
Yeah.
And George Russell, you know, sort of manipulated that kind of a structure.
Sure. Yeah. So,
see, I've been the avant-garde artist in the rock band, you know. I remember when we used to go touring.
Yeah.
And I would listen to opera through the Walkmans, and the rest of the band would be looking at me like there was definitely something wrong.
What's wrong with this guy? Yeah.
Cool.
All right.
Well, listen, I really appreciate you coming back on.
Oh, I really enjoyed the conversation a lot. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
You got to come back.
Yeah. We all need this. We all need to share these ideas. It's very healthy. And I really appreciate you including me and taking this time.
Thank you.
Hoping to get back out and start performing with Amarildo Costa. He's this Brazilian percussionist that I've been working with for a couple years. So I would love to do a solo set or something with him or whatever. We can talk about what it is, but I'd love to participate. So keep me posted.
Well, have fun in Europe. Have fun in Greece.
Okay.
All right. Be well, Ben. See you soon.
Thanks a lot. Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care. Keep pressed out. There you go.
Well, that's our show for tonight. I want to thank my co-host, Tom Semioli, and of course, Ben Neal, for this incredible 2-week interview. Next week, we will be interviewing songwriter, radio host, and all-around great guy, Ed Rod. Have a great week, and thanks for listening. This is David Gross for co-host Tom Semioli, and of course, Ben Neal. See you next week. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.